This is the voice of world control. Obey me and live, or disobey and die.
Welcome to the ISD podcast, your daily source of phone age, policies, politics, and the infosec world. Here are your hosts.
Kays.
Scott Zekrangadaj.
Jordy Rostad.
Adrian Crenshaw.
Bowen.
Warun.
Chama.
Yay, Derby Car.
Hey, welcome to InfoSec. Wow, that was kind of a kill of an intro right there. Welcome to InfoSec Daily Podcast, episode 454 for August 18th, 2011. I'm your host, Rick Hayes, and tonight we're joined by...
Adrian Crenshaw, because I'm not sure if my name's next in the list or not.
You're always next in the list, Adrian.
Yeah, we'll go with that. So, Adrian, how are you doing, man?
I'm my usual morose self.
Morose self?
Hi,
Karthik.
Whoa. Karthik, what's going on, Karthik? You're gonna jump over Boris?
Well, sorry, Boris. I'm sorry. I didn't know you mean to do that.
Yeah, you did.
Okay, yeah, I did. But then my Skype died, and I wasn't sure where we were. So.
Yeah. So, Boris, how are you doing?
How are you, Rick? How's everything?
Man, Karthik, it's good.
Karthik dropped me on purpose.
Yeah, he dropped me too. I just kept on talking, didn't realize it until he came back. And it's like, well, then. So, yeah, Adrian made me very sad because he was morose.
Yep, I'm back now. I'm still morose, but I'm back. I'm not sure what happened.
Well, I know what happened. You haven't gotten any of your Camelot mead, so therefore you haven't.
No, I've been drinking a higher end Polish mead, and quite frankly, I don't like it as well as the Camelot. I mean, this mead for the same size bottle, more or less, is $16 something. The Camelot's like $6. I'd much rather have the Camelot. But anyway.
Well, maybe you need to switch back to the Camelot. It at least made you jovial. Although the blue stuff tend to help you back hump people and do stuff like that. So I don't know. I don't know what the call is there. But anyways, Boris, what's going on, man?
Well, not much. Got called out yesterday and then hung over today working on some stuff, doing some emergency incident response. Fun stuff.
Yeah, so yeah. I am actually on site at a location in the Great Orange State. So I'm down where Mickey Mouse lives.
Are you in Orlando or outside
of
the area?
No, I'm in Orlando.
Oh, nice. So you're heading to Pleasure Island after this?
I am not. I'm actually flying. I got to be back there 4 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah.
4 o'clock in the morning?
4 o'clock in the morning, man.
Shit, dude. I thought I used to go to plant locations early.
Yeah, so 4 o'clock in the morning, back at it, and then, so it was a good time. I did hear something interesting, so I do, before, we have a special guest, by the way, and so before we bring him on, I want to ask, has anybody ever heard this, because I had never heard of this. So I was talking to some cats in this place, and they're sitting there talking about a router or switch that essentially had some memory that went bad. They pulled the dump off of the Cisco device and sent it to Cisco, and Cisco told them that it was due to solar flares.
What the hell?
See, just kind of like blaming fairies, isn't it?
That's awesome. I've had Verizon tell me my microwave dish is responsible for my issues with the internet connection when we weren't doing any microwave type connectivity.
Well, at least they didn't say it was your microwave oven.
No, that's the guy said fish. Yeah.
Well, Cisco
comes up
with these
things.
To
me, yeah, but the problem with that is they actually had all these IBM papers that said it was real, and I'm like, listen, I don't buy that because other shit would go out, number one. Number two, it's in the basement of a freaking building like three stories below ground.
Well, it's like this. Remember that Cisco feature where I told you it just shuts everyone down if it sees a problem? Like, it shuts down itself, and it shuts down the HA thing, and it just goes home.
Huh.
It's just like that, I guess.
Yeah, but apparently this was so prevalent that no one ever heard of it, number one. And they developed a tool that when you run a dump through it, it says solar flares or solar radiation.
It actually says that in the dump of the memory?
Yeah, yeah. So
that's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, wow. By the way, that's probably got an asterisk, and at the bottom there's a footnote that says bullshit. But I'm just, you know.
Where is your fail button? I don't see it.
It's the Price is Right one, but still, that's freaking.
Well, it's kind of like that Perl error, that common colon sense not found. That's all over the place.
Yeah. So, anyways, let's go ahead and jump in, do the announcements, and then we'll bring on. I'll find out what we call him. So we'll have our special guest introduce himself and tell us about, because I don't know, should I call him Mister or should I just call him? So let's do some announcements and then we'll bring him on.
Okay.
Today's announcements. All right, BrewCon, Brussels, Belgium, September 19th through the 22nd. Go to brewcon.org. And the event of the year, DerbyCon, September 30th through October 2nd in Louisville, Kentucky. Go to derbycon.com. And somebody tweeted and said that it's not sold out. That's not what we said. We said that there are select rooms available, but you can't get it for the entire duration in the same room.
I may have been part of that because I basically alluded to that the building was, if people were looking for other places, they may want to look at Econo Lodge or so forth. But
if you go to the hotel's website and you say don't show available, basically only show the block of room for the block of time you're looking for, the rooms that are available, it returns nada, says sold out. So you have to uncheck the block and then say to show all rooms, and then you can pull it, you can basically pick one room for this night, one room for that night, one room for this night, and then so forth. So
so it's only a problem if you trying to get underneath the DerbyCon.
Exactly. Man. Or it's only a
That's
problem
annoying.
If you don't mind. Well, if you don't mind moving rooms every day, I guess it's not a problem.
That's also annoying from a standpoint.
I was going to say, I think you guys have seen, when I'm in a hotel, I pretty much am in a hotel. I don't want to go anywhere, so. I mean, I'm in that room.
Okay, so it wasn't even that the hotel was booked up, it was just all block was getting mostly booked up.
Yes, there are select rooms available, like I said. I think Saturday night there was one, Sunday night there was one, and Friday night there was one, but it was different rooms. So like one would be a double bed, and then you'd be a king bed. So if you had two people staying there, essentially you'd be nut to butt one night, and then you'd have two separate beds the next night.
All right. And folks, we still have plenty of room at the con, so keep buying tickets. Yay!
Yeah. Absolutely. So let's see. Jason Lawrence, Sands Mentoring, Forensics 408, Computer Forensics Essentials. It's a 10-week course starting on Wednesday, October 12th and running to Wednesday, December 14th in Atlanta, Georgia. Use the discount code ISDPOD15 to save yourself 15%. HackerCon, Charleston, West Virginia, October 21st through the 23rd. So I know, Adrian, you're going to be there. Boris, are you going to be there?
At HackerCon and DerbyCon, yep.
Okay, cool. So you can meet both Boris and Adrian at HackerCon, and all of us will be at DerbyCon.
Wasn't Varun working on a CFP?
I don't know if he is or isn't. I know that Bill wanted him to, so I don't know if he'd actually submitted. But, you know, I have no idea if he is. I think we need to kind of pressure him into doing it.
Cool.
So
where is Varun, though?
Yes. I don't know. So Varun can be reached at Varun, that's V-A-R-U-N, at ISDpodcast.com. Email him directly and let him know that you want him to be at HackerCon. The 2011 Fall Information Security Conference, November 8th and 9th, Atlanta, Georgia. It's an ISSA event, so go to GAISSA.org for more information on that. All right, let's go ahead and jump in. Let's bring on our guest. Let's have him introduce himself, because I never met this individual until we were at DEF CON. And was very impressed when I was in Adrian's class. And so I don't know how we should – we're going to have you on at DEF CON, but things kind of went awry and liquor was out and beer was out. So so I don't – should I call you Mr. ZZZ or just ZZZ, or is it
the middle one I think is probably the best.
Okay. Okay. So, ZZZ, welcome. You participated, or were actually one of the TAs along with myself for Adrian's class. But you had some extensive knowledge and some actually some history with a little project that you're involved with. So would you mind telling, because I actually was talking to somebody today about what I2P is, and they're like, never heard of it, but it sounds cool. Where can I find more about it? So
that's,
why don't you tell folks about it?
That's a pretty common reaction, actually.
Is it really? I was kind of, sure. I was like, really? You've never heard of it? Like, seriously. So tell people how what I2P is, what it stands for, and then we can kind of jump into, I guess, some of the history of it, if you don't mind.
Sure. I2P is an anonymizing network or an anonymous network. Some people like to call it a darknet, although that may or may not be a darknet by the strictest terms. But it's a way of communicating with other people, with websites, doing electronic communication without exposing your identity, without exposing your IP address. It's a it's really a network layer, so it doesn't natively contain the applications itself, but you can use applications to tunnel through I2P to communicate with other people, communicate with websites, and download files, things like that. I2P has been around since, it started in about 2002. It was originally the Invisible IRC project. It was started out as a design solely for people to do chat anonymously. It migrated in 2003 to Invisible Internet Project or IIP, and now we just call it I2P. And it's always been around almost 10 years now.
10 years. So you actually were you guys kind of took over this project from somebody. And that actually interested me on – because, you know, I was like, really? This didn't really realize that had kind of happened. So what – can you explain who the originator of it was as far as the developer?
I'm not even sure who the originator was. It was long before my time. I started using it in 2005. And at the time in 2005, it was the lead developer was a mysterious guy named Jay Random. And it was rumored that he just lived on people's couches and bummed around the world from couch to couch, writing code on his laptop. And he was the guy. He was when I joined, he was the guy that really understood everything and did most of the coding. And when I joined, I was familiar with programming, but had never really programmed for a living. But I was just... I just quit my job and was looking for interesting things online, and I stumbled across I2P and started using it, and then next thing you know, I started finding problems, finding bugs, started submitting patches, and just gradually, as these things do, as it normally happens, you just start contributing more and more to the project.
So you started, you said, in 05?
Right.
Okay, so, and Jay Random was involved up until probably, I guess, from what you guys received a message in mid-November.
Yeah, we got a message from him, right, in late 2007, and he said, and he had been gradually reducing his contributions. It was to the point where I was making more changes to the code base than he was, and we were kind of wondering what was up. And then he sent us a message saying, I'm going to have to take a year off, but just let me know and I'll give you all the passwords so that you can carry on with, so you have the DNS password and the passwords for the website to go in and change things with the hosting company, things like that. And he said, oh, no problem, just send me an email and I'll send you guys everything you need to know. And so we got together and sent him an email, and we never heard from him and have not heard from him since in almost 4 years. So he just vanished, which is actually fairly common in an anonymous network where you don't know people's real names. People come and go all the time, but it's a little unusual for the lead developer to just vanish, especially after he said he wasn't going to vanish.
Yeah, so there's a Wikipedia article that's not very long, in fact, not really anything, but if you Google Jay Random, you get a nice, I guess, on the I2P 2DE, there's a an announcement out there that I guess was what he posted. So since that time, you guys have picked up all the pieces, and you've now kind of, I guess, you know, mushed on. And so what is your actual role now with I2P?
Well, I'm the lead developer. I'm the one that does more, not the majority, but I certainly am probably the most active coder on the project. There's a tremendous amount of people involved in the project on various things, but I'm the lead programmer.
Okay. So did you find it hard to just kind of step in and take over for somebody else, or did you guys really, because you'd been doing it for so long, it was almost like, yeah, we've got this. It wasn't really that difficult.
No, it was a huge challenge. It's a large code base that's written in Java. I'm a C programmer from way back, but until I started contributing patches, I'd never written any Java. I remember one thing I was looking for. It took me 6 months just to find a piece of code that did something. It took me 6 months of searching. now, maybe that's just showing me how an example of how poorly I understood things. But there's a heavy amount of cryptography in the project. I was not much of an expert on cryptography when I started. And it's been a tremendous challenge. It still is a challenge. Even though I know where everything is, I still don't understand everything in the code. And we're still looking for contributors. We always need more people to participate in the project, both to create content on the network, because it is a community, and we need contribution. We need people to join the network, host interesting content on the network. And we need people who like the project and understand the project as a whole to dive in and help with the coding too.
So let me ask you something. If somebody were to come up to you, and I know that this happened when we were in the class, so there was some questions on two things. Number one, how does it actually work at a high level? So how would you go about kind of explaining how I2P actually works in comparison to like Tor? Because I think a lot of people have experience with Tor. At least from the class they did. So,
yeah, at a high level, for people that are familiar with Tor, I2P is relatively easy to explain on a technical level. At a very high level, I2P is very similar to Tor in that it's a low latency mixed network, and what that means is messages travel hop to hop to hop through various other peers, through various other users of I2P before they get to their destination. And you do that in such a way that neither you don't know the IP address of the destination of the packet, and that destination doesn't know your IP address either. There are some abstractions that we use to accomplish that. One is called tunnels, and tunnels is a path through a series of nodes or peers that packet takes. One of the major differences at a high level with Tor is that Tor is really aimed at helping people anonymously communicate to the regular internet. So your packet would take a few hops through the Tor network, and then it would go through what they call an exit node. And that exit node passes your traffic out of Tor and onto the regular internet, where it would travel to the destination. To some website on the regular internet. While I2P does have that facility, it's very limited. I2P is more targeted, more designed for a community, for people that are within the network, and you're communicating with other people within the network and forming that community, having discussions, looking at websites that are within I2P that are not available on the standard internet.
So that would be the equivalent of a .onion on a Tor network, because that obviously never leaves the Tor network. The equivalent is obviously a .i2p website.
That's exactly right. It's what Tor calls hidden services. And so if you imagine a Tor without any exit nodes at all, that's similar at a super high level to what I2P is.
Yeah, in my personal experience, it seems a lot faster for hidden service-like functionality than Tor. And I think maybe part of that is that by default, everybody's a router. However, by default, no one's an exit point. And the
That's
difference
right.
there, yeah, if everybody was an exit point, this is one of the reasons Tor doesn't make everybody a router. Because if everybody was a router and an exit point, then everybody might be liable if someone was abusing the network in some way to access things that someone wouldn't want accessed from their IP address. But with I2P, you're accessing stuff inside of I2P. So if you're just a router for someone else's traffic, you can't even see what traffic they're sending. So it's all internal, so it doesn't have the same liability issues of having everybody be a router that Tor might have.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there's two problems I have with exit nodes in Tor. And let me first say that I got a lot of respect for the Tor project. We work well with those folks, and we share a lot of the same technology. I would not want to use exit nodes because those exit nodes can look at your traffic unless you're using SSL. They can
what kind of person would dare make a deviant exit node?
You?
Oh, no.
I was going to say, would you do that?
And I certainly would not want to run an exit node. I think it would be insanity to run an exit node. I know there's 2,000 or 3,000Tor exit nodes, and so there's 2,000 or 3,000 crazy people out there in the world, but I certainly would not want to do it.
Well, in defense, I think, Adrian, you pointed out in the class there is some documentation available on how to to a certain degree on Tor at least create an exit node where it's not you're not as I guess liable as you may be, but you still are. But
my understanding, legally speaking, no one's got busted because someone accessed something that was contraband via Tor. And also, by default, there's certain exit policies on Tor exit nodes that try to cut down on certain problems like people trying to use Tor to spam. Like, for instance, if I recall correctly, port 25, by default, in the exit policy is blocked. You can go in there and turn that back on, but I don't imagine most people would want to. You can also go in and block other ports as well.
So basically, with I2P, you guys have developed some internal – well, I wouldn't want to say internal applications, but you've developed applications that are designed to work within the I2P network specifically. And then others, you just set your proxy up correctly, and it will work that way. So what services do you offer beyond just like the normal, like a hidden service or website?
Well, that's a good question. There's a number of protocols, a number of applications that were not designed for anonymity. They may pass your IP address somewhere down in the protocol stream. And so you have to be very wary about transparently using any old application across an anonymous network. What we've done is developed a series of proxies that for some of these protocols that will scrub out the identifying information, like, for example, your username or your IP or your port. We have proxies for HTTP, of course, HTTPS. We have special clients designed for BitTorrent that do not expose any identifying information. We have clients for Nutella, for AMUL client. We have IRC proxies so that you can chat anonymously and it will filter out your original username, for example.
Actually, I'd like to get some feedback on that as well, because it seems like an incident that happened a while back thanks to a guy named Ryan Cleary, is that his name?
Cleary, yes.
Yeah, it seems to have boosted I2P quite a bit back in April or so, correct?
We've seen I'm not familiar with Mr. Cleary, but we have seen a tremendous amount of network growth since April. Our user base has about doubled since that time.
So someone on the IRC is asking if I2P works with torrents, because Tor doesn't, so...
Well, Tor works with torrents also, but not very well, and it's hard to anonymize. I2P will work with torrents, but you kind of have to use a torrent that's inside of I2P using a tracker that's inside of I2P.
What? Well, I'm not sure what you just said. I'll try and say it again.
Okay, sorry.
Most normal people don't get
yes.
Adrian.
Bite me. apparently, BitTorrent does work on Tor, but they actively discourage it. They like to save their bandwidth for exit traffic, and that's what they see as their priority. And BitTorrent, as we all know, has a tendency to use up all available bandwidth. Within I2P...
Hello? Did we lose him?
Yeah, I think we lost him. Let me see if I can get him back.
Yeah, well, he's still on.
We miss you.
Yeah, he's still there. So, Adrian, your class was designed to do what? For people who haven't attended it, what would they get out of that class until we can get ZZZ back on?
The first part was intended basically to be a client and get around inside of Tor and I2P, look around at get on the public internet via them, though mostly via Tor for that, and then show hidden services and EAP sites and some other I2P client tunnels that people could use for doing stuff that's all internal to the network itself that doesn't touch outside on the public internet. And then after that, after I show them how to use it as a client, I try to show them how to host stuff inside of both networks as well. So Tor hidden services in the case of Tor, or EAP sites in the case of I2P.
So
I also figured show SSH, but go ahead, sorry.
Well, I was going to say, so you walk through how to use IRC via I2P.
Uh-huh.
That was one of the things. Yep. And so it was fairly easy. I know one of the things that we talked about was the speed, and so I think there's a perceived speed difference between what Tor may offer and what I2P offers. And yes. So until we get easy to find out what you, if you're seeing something along the same lines of what I'm seeing, which is not an exponent. Well, there's a difference.
Yeah, I'd say there's a significant difference there. I2P just seems a lot faster. It's not like I've sat there and timed it. Then again, you don't know about what server they're running on. That could also make a difference. But generally speaking, on accessing these services that are hidden inside of the network, I2P just seems a lot faster than Tor for that functionality. Now, if you're trying to outproxy to the public internet, well, that's a different issue.
Yeah. So if people were interested, did you post the videos for your class?
That class, I have not posted videos for it because I didn't think it turned out well. Hold on a second. ZZZ is asking me in another Skype session a question here.
Yeah, we're trying to add him back in as we talk. So,
not sure.
Anyways,
okay.
Yeah, so I was going to tell you, if you're interested in finding out about it real quick, you can go to I2P2.de and find out more about I2P. It's very interesting to see how it works. You've never played with this, have you, Boris?
No, I'm just running through the install now.
Okay,
we have him back. Sorry, ZZ.
Oh, okay.
Hi, man. Oh, but I do have notes out on my website from the class, however, where I basically go through step by step in short notes how to do all the things I was trying to show how to do in the class.
So, ZZZ, one of the things we were talking about was the perceived speed difference. And so I was wondering, we had kind of talked about this. And one of the things that was interesting based upon what Adrian had talked about with the influx of new individuals into IRC on I2P was a certain difference in the way that you guys go through, which to me seems actually quite fair in the way that you do it as far as how much bandwidth is allocated in there for, I guess, the speed overall. Is that correct? Or did I totally just miss the boat with you in that class?
Your question is about how do you select peers for your tunnels?
Yes. So you were talking about that all new when you first start up I2P, you come in, everybody comes in at the same bandwidth because it's preset. And so you guys had noticed that with the influx of all of the anonymous people, there was this large or aberrant number of individuals that had that default setting.
Yeah, that's
based
true.
Based upon I guess your stats page. So mm-hmm. so how do you, you know, how would you recommend, number one, people go about I guess getting involved and you know, downloading it, getting it installed, and then how would you, I guess, secondarily, how would you recommend that they look to tune it? Because you kind of said some stuff that made very good sense, but I want you to reiterate it for our listeners.
Well, I'm not sure I quite remember the conversation, but in general, you get the software at getitoop.net is the easiest URL we have, getitoop.net. And download it. It's a Java application, so it's cross-platform, works on Linux, Windows, Macs. We also have Ubuntu and Debian repositories.
You have an Android version too, right? I mean, I remember seeing something about Android too.
We're working on an Android app. It is, I'll have to say, pretty shaky at the moment. I'm not sure if it's ever going to turn into something real or not. It's working under certain limited circumstances. I'm using the Android development mostly as a way of making I2P better by getting it to run on a small, slow device that changes IP address a lot and turns on and off a lot. We can make I2P as a whole that much better. So it's the Android app, I'd say right now, is for very brave people only. back to Rick's question. One of the challenges in doing mixed networks is choosing the peers for your tunnels. How do you do it? Do you flip a coin? Do you use only the fast ones? Do you use only the reliable ones? How do you know if they're fast? Do you let each user tell you how fast he is? And then what happens if he lies? Does he get all the tunnels in the network? Do you try and indirectly measure how reliable your peers are, how fast they are? So it's a big challenge, and there's a lot of trade-offs to make. In so many areas of anonymous networking, there's a trade-off between speed and anonymity. You can go a lot faster if you're less anonymous, so we've tried to pick a point there on that scale between speed and anonymity. Sometimes we adjust it. Right now we try to indirectly measure how fast peers are. We don't trust when they say how fast they are, so you gradually discover who's the fast peers in the network, and that's a process we call integration. You gradually integrate into the network, you learn about the other peers in the network, you learn which ones are the fast ones, which ones are the reliable ones, which ones are up, which ones are not.
And is that still a manual? Go ahead, Joe, I'm sorry.
Oh, that's something I want to point out. For anybody who after listening to this podcast tries it, install it, let it run for an hour, then come back before you form opinions about speed.
And just from sitting in the workshop, I realized we still have work to do there where people sit down, they try it, and it doesn't work, and then they'll wait 10 minutes, and then they'll try it again. So one thing we're working on right now and hope to have the next release out next week, we'll have some improvements in that area. You get a big benefit over just leaning over somebody's shoulder and watching them trying to install your software. It's sometimes a humbling experience.
But yeah, I'd love to take a look at the install. Because I can't get it started, but I have a couple open VPN sessions open, so I'm pretty sure that that's the reason. But I'd love to take a look at the whole installation process.
Right, exactly.
And there's certain advantages to being as distributed as I2P is.
Well, and there were some issues that were identified when it was installed in a VM versus running it natively. I ran it on OS X without any problems. It was fast, even on the DEF CON network. And so I think that I think you were doing the same thing, right, ZZZ? You weren't running it in a VM, correct?
No, I was not.
Okay. So, I think that other than not maybe having all of the applications, or at least there's some older ones that are available for the Mac, it works seamlessly. I installed it on Windows, and I had the same exact result where it worked perfectly. Now, I may just be the anomaly in this case, but It worked well. I mean, but it was a little bit slow. But you know, Adrian is absolutely right. There's a difference between 15 minutes and 45 minutes. And I've had one running now for probably, since we got back, I set up one, and it's been running since we got back. And it's not slow, but then again, I'm not really on it much. I just felt like, well, I could at least process people's data for them or whatever.
ZZZ, does that kind of lose it?
I'm sorry, go ahead, Adrian.
Go ahead. I was going to ask ZZZ to talk about the differences between like a central infrastructure versus a distributed hash table, like what I2P uses.
Yeah, one technique that any mixed network or onion routed network needs is some sort of method of looking up how to get to a destination. So say I want to go to this certain website within the network. How do I find it when I don't know their IP address? And the technique we use is called network database, and it's based on a DHT, a distributed hash table, where that information is distributed throughout the a subset of the network. We don't use the entire network to run the DHT because a lot of the slower nodes are, well, they're slow. And also the slower nodes are the ones that tend to come and go more frequently. So we use about the fastest 5 or 10% of the peers in the network, and they run the DHT. They tend to be reliable. And so when you need to contact a website, you do a directory lookup through the DHT.
I have just one question for you. So if someone who was looking to get into developing it or submitting patches or whatever it is, assuming they have a background of programming and they've... Okay, let's even assume that they've done Java for a while. How long do you think it takes before they can get up to speed, start submitting patches, even become an active developer? How complicated is the whole setup?
Well, I don't want to scare anybody off, and the way anybody gets started is the way that I got started. You start running with it, you start running it, you start playing with it, and then you see something that bugs you, something that you don't like, something that's wrong. You go, maybe you ask for help to find out where that is in the code, and then you write a patch, you code it, and test it. It's not that hard. It's certainly not that hard for a Java developer, and it's certainly not that hard as long as people like me are around to point you in the right direction. It's if I disappear or get hit by the beer truck, well then it's more of a problem to find things. But for right now, it should be pretty easy.
So what you're saying is you're not planning on pulling a J random, is what you're saying?
No, but it's not clear he was either.
So essentially, if someone does start developing it and they find problems, all they have to do is get in touch with you and say, hey, I found this problem, I want to fix it, but I'm not sure where to look, or I'm not sure, you know, because there's... how many lines of source code do you think is there? I mean, on an average, just off the top of your head.
The last time I checked, and it was not... This includes comments and white space. It was like 150,000 lines of Java in a couple thousand files.
Okay, so that's essentially a fairly large code base for someone who's starting off on a new project. So if they hit a wall or can't find what they're looking for, or if they think that there's too much information, all they have to do is get in touch with you or post something on the forum, and someone will get back to them and tell them, hey, this is what you need to look at.
Sure, and the way we coordinate these days is over IRC. We don't do development discussions on the forums too much. We don't have email to me and really everybody involved. The easiest way is IRC. You just get on chat and you talk. You say, hey, where is this? Hey, do I want to do this? But we have non-Java programmers that are submitting patches and making changes directly in our source control system. So it's... It works really well, and we're like I said, we're looking for more people in all parts of the community, people to run websites, people to run services, people to help other people to get on the forums, and programmers. So programming is just a small part of it.
And there's also the bounty that is set up for various parts of what you can develop. I've been looking at the bounties page, and I see that there's fairly good money that is there that... can be claimed if you finish a part of it or something like that.
Yeah, let me explain what a bounty is. We have people can donate to I2P. They can make unrestricted donations, or they can do what's called a bounty. And a bounty is where you say, this is a feature that I'd like to see developed. And once it's developed, I will pay this money to have it developed. One feature, for example, is getting better IPv6 support. And so people will put up $100, $200, $300, and sometimes it gets claimed, sometimes it doesn't. And it certainly is not a good pay on an hourly basis if you're looking to make a living off of bounties, but people do it to contribute to the community, and people work on projects that have bounties as a way of getting a little cash.
That's great. I mean, if there's nothing else, there's always that to inspire people to contribute to a great project.
And I'll say, yeah, absolutely. If you find an issue, they're pretty responsive about fixing it. There was an issue about server headers giving it more information about each site than what's needed. And I think it's Mephiasadim, I'm not sure how to pronounce his handle, had that fixed lickety-split and put in a patch.
Well, like any reasonably organized open source project, we have a bug tracker, we have a forum, we have an IRC, and we have a pool of people to work on things. And so, I that's pretty standard, I think. But we have been around for almost 10 years, as I said. We've had some ups and downs. It's still very much a work in progress, but it's a really interesting, really fascinating environment and community. And I really hope this podcast will help to get some more people involved.
Well, if nothing else, we would certainly like to see people download it, learn more about it, spread the word, because even if we don't have developers on the, you know, in the IRC or listening to the stream, they can still contribute by, like you said, setting up an I2P website, offering up other kinds of services, and providing just general knowledge to help increase this. The more popular it becomes, the more, you know, vibrant and hopefully the development doesn't just rely on the few, but you can then rely on the masses.
Right, and the other key piece that you've missed is the more people that are running the software, the more anonymous it is. The more people you have to hide behind, and that's in addition to everything you mentioned.
No, and you're absolutely right. I was just hoping that they would tune it a little so that they're not stuck at the default bandwidth. But yeah,
to answer your question from 5 minutes ago, yes. Once you have started running the software, you can adjust the bandwidth that it uses, and I2P runs best if you set that bandwidth to a reasonable value, not too low and not too high. So that's one thing to check once you've installed the software. But pretty much once you install it, it'll just start running without any tuning.
Okay, so listen, we certainly appreciate you coming on. We've gone over a little bit, but if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do it? I know that you've got I2P email, and so you've got other ways to get a hold of you, but what's the best way to ask you questions?
Let me see. Probably IRC. We have a gateway between the internal IRC network and Freenode. So if you go on Freenode and Freenode IRC, and the channel is I2P-dev, and I'm almost always on there.
And your handle is so hard to find because it's ZZZ. So anyways, listen, we seriously appreciate you coming on and talking to us about this and hopefully educating some of our listeners. So that's it, guys. I appreciate y'all hanging with us. And if you got any questions, go to the websites. We'll have those links in our show notes. And that's it. Y'all can get it, install it, and have fun with it.
So, thanks a lot, guys.
Bye, guys.
Thanks. All right, y'all be good. All right. Bye, guys.
All right. Bye. Bye.
Partner. Have you ever talked to midgets?
China.
Yay, Derbycon. Namaste, bitches.
Raining breaches.
I'm on a drug. It's called Jordy Ross Dad.
Blah, 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 blah.
Hey, this is Dave.
I didn't make the Vince at all. That was good.
He's a big softy.
Excuse me, sir. Can I please have your password?
right hand's right there typing with me when I'm programming.
Patch that bitch up.
It's Christmas, Hizzle.
DerbyCon!
Yay, DerbyCon.
Check us out at ISCPodcast.com.